It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about why the Federal Trade Commission is pursuing legal action against a major wireless provider and what you should watch for on your cell phone bills.
First, we're building off our conversation yesterday with business professor Morris Davis about the brain drain in Wisconsin. Young Wisconsinites are leaving the state after getting their college degree. Some of them come back years later to raise a family, and some of them don't.
Yesterday, Professor Davis explained why the brain drain is a huge economic burden on the state of Wisconsin. He also shared some solutions, things like tax breaks or maybe discounted tuition for students who commit to staying in the state after they graduate.
Right now, we're talking to another guest concerned about the brain drain. She's a member of the millennial generation, which includes people born between 1981 and the year 2000, and she's trying to attract her peers to Door County. Caitlin Olson joins us now. She's a social media strategist at 3W Media. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start by getting your personal story. You grew up in Door County and then you left. Why did you leave? What made you decide to make that choice?
I grew up in Sister Bay, Wisconsin, which has a population of 800 people. So I really wanted to try something new and have new experiences. So I left at 18 after graduating and went to the New School in New York, where I got my undergraduate degree and thought I wanted to get even further away. And so I moved to Edinburgh, Scotland to get a master's degree at the University of Edinburgh. And I liked it so much, I stayed for 2 extra years. And finally, I moved home in September of 2013 because my visa expired.
Oh, so you've only been home for a little while then. So what drew you back to Door County?
Well, like a lot of other millennials, I wanted to live at home to use as a base to find a job in Madison, which kind of started all of this because I didn't really have a lot of money coming home, and I wanted to pick up some extra money by working at 3W, which is owned by my mom and stepfather.
And along the way, you noticed something. You noticed that there didn't seem to be the huge numbers of millennials in Door County, and you've tried to kind of beat the drum about this and raise awareness and get millennials interested in moving there. What kind of was a red flag to you about millennials in Door County?
While I started my job search in Madison, I was coming across Epic, Sonic Foundry, tech companies like Google and Zendesk and the biotech startup industry, and thought, there are a lot of people down here, a lot of young people with great salaries. Why are they not in Door County? It's 3.5 hours away. We've got 5 state parks, 19 county parks, 20 beaches, and we just broke ground in Sturgeon Bay with an awesome skate park. So to me, it seemed kind of like a no-brainer, easy to get to. Why aren't there more people here? And secondly, when I came home, I was really impressed with Sister Bay. About 2 years ago, it was kind of a bit more bleak. A lot of businesses were closed down in the city center, village center. And in the past 2 years, it's like a totally different area. It's vibrant. There's a lot of new business owners that are young. And so it's really due to these young business owners that Sister Bay is seeing this great change.
I think in Wisconsin, if you don't live in Door County, a lot of people think of it as a place that you go to vacation, not necessarily a place that you live in. Can you make the case for why people should move to live, make their permanent home in Door County?
Definitely. First off, if you don't like the outdoors and you can't entertain yourself, you're not going to like living in Door County. So that's something you kind of have to figure out. And there are a lot of other great parts of the state that have other unique attributes to offer young people. But Door County, it's the outdoors. That's the main focus. So I would say that, you know, if you're someone that likes to be outside and you like being outdoor activities year round, this is the place for you to be. And now we're seeing such a great influx of new young business owners in the area that it is starting to get a bit more popular, but we're not really reaching out to millennials, and that's kind of what our initiative started from.
So in the press, you know, you hear a lot about how millennials seem to prefer dense urban areas because for one reason, they don't have to own a car. Mm-hmm. They can bike and use public transportation, and that's not the place or the case in somewhere like Door County. Does that make it a harder sell?
Yes and no. Something I've talked about with 3W Media, who I'm working with and did the ebook with our client Door County Inns and Resorts, we've talked about what we really want to push for is a Zipcar franchise, which might sound a bit weird, but it would be really handy to have, not only for people coming up and traveling around and visiting Door County, but also people living there. We do have a lot of student workers, and it'd be great for them just to have the ability to utilize that as well, and not having to feel like, oh, I have to have a car to be in Door County to get to my two or three jobs.
Now, you said you noticed in your hometown of Sister Bay that you were impressed with it recently. Like, a lot of things you noticed were changing. There was new vitality there, and you put that down to millennials who are active as business owners. Can you tell us about some of the things that are happening in Door County thanks to the millennials who are changing?
That's a huge part of it. And another important part that I think other parts of the state can do is incorporating millennials in community organizations, community boards. And I know there's been an argument saying that young people aren't interested. And I would say we are interested. Part of it is some of us have a lot of student loan debt or are burdened with having to work two or three jobs just to pay rent. The other is, you know, you have to reach out to us and ask us. Because if you start asking us and listening to our opinions and our concerns, we'll be a lot more apt to trust, you know, older generations, the retiree generations, and really want to help revitalize the community.
Now, yesterday in our discussion about brain drain, our guest focused on economic development in urban areas of Wisconsin, places like Madison and Milwaukee. What about rural communities? Why is it important to focus on them?
I would say because that's most of Wisconsin. You know, Madison and Milwaukee are great urban environments, and that's a whole other topic of conversation. But I would say the backbone of Wisconsin are these rural communities, and I think that a unique way to look at this problem is by saying that we need to work together as a community to address economic development. And part of that, I just read an article an hour ago on Forbes.com about how almost 2/3 of millennials would like to start their own company. So we're not really going the route of other generations where we want to have a specific job for 10 to 20, 30 years, save up money, and then eventually open up the business, our dream business that we've always wanted to do. We're more apt to start our dream business now. And I think that that's something that other communities can appreciate and need to take advantage of, is that spirit and working together to really create a strong community. Because I know from my personal experience, I have a lot of friends and classmates in Door County and in other parts of the country that would jump at the opportunity to return home and work, either starting up their own cafe or bar or working, starting their own marketing or communications business. And we really need to cultivate that strong sense of community to get that to work.
That's really interesting, because I think you hear that people leave rural areas because there aren't jobs. You're saying, you know, maybe that's not as much of an issue in Door County and other rural areas because millennials like to make their own jobs. Is that right?
Yeah. And I'd say to that as well, every community has their own community business leaders, people that have done really well for 20, 30 years. And these people really, you know, I would love to see them reaching out to millennial business owners and saying, like, what do you need? Starting that dialogue of what can I help you with? Not necessarily financial support, but creating those financial initiatives, as well as just like support, you know, offering you my advice. Because I think when you start that dialogue, a lot of trust comes from that. And, you know, this not everyone will fit into this kind of category this way, but I think it's a great way to start a better dialogue about it.
So in terms of the job market itself, if you don't have that entrepreneurial spirit that you're talking about as a millennial, and you just want a job, are there jobs there? If you've got if you're putting out the call for millennials to move to Door County, will they find something to do?
Yes, there's a lot of jobs, from, you know, being a kayak tour guide to working at a local brewery in Bailey's Harbor, to working in lodging, to running for a political office in the community. There's a lot of different jobs to fill, and a lot of, yeah, so it's not just, you don't just have to be an entrepreneur.
Does having a smaller group of your peers, in this case millennials, where you live, does that change the way the place feels to you?
That's an interesting question. I would say, well, yes, I think in some ways, because it's smaller, it almost feels like it's a stronger community, because everyone from people I see and interact with, it's people are much more willing to help each other, and it feels stronger. Everyone kind of knows each other, and yeah, in that way, I would say it's a bit stronger, even though it's a smaller percentage.
If it's someone who's not from the area, will they be welcomed in?
I think so. I think we're a very welcoming community.
We're talking right now with social media strategist and millennial Caitlin Olson about what it will take to attract younger people to visit and live in Door County. And we're taking your calls next. Are you seeing the brain drain in your community? And what are you doing to attract young people back to your city or your town? What do you think Wisconsin needs to do to retain its younger residents? And if you're a millennial, what would it take to keep you in the Badger State? And questions about Door County, we're happy to take those too. 800-642-1234 is our number. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our conversation now with social media strategist and millennial Caitlin Olson about what it would take to attract young people to Door County. And we're taking your calls right now. If you're a millennial, why do you think that in some cases millennials seem to be drawn to cities, and what would it take to get them to move somewhere like Door County? What obstacles do you see? And what do you think the state stands to gain by getting people into areas like Door County? 800-642-1234 is our number. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Kevin with us from Onalaska. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
What do you think?
I was just calling to plug an organization called SCORE, and they are a group of retired business folks that help young entrepreneurs. But as the subject you guys are talking about, they're not very known. Like, I didn't just come across them very easily. And so they meet at the Chamber of Commerce once every Monday, and they help young entrepreneurs write business plans and get their feet off the ground.
And this is a statewide group?
I'm not sure. I know that it's in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Okay. So it's a organization called SCORE that helps young people start businesses. Thank you for that call, Kevin. Are there existing resources like that in Door County that you know of, Caitlin?
There's DCEDC, which is Door County Economic Development Corporation, and they offer some great grant loan programs, as well as they have a partnership with UWGB, and GB sends up a mentor, and they meet every month, which is great. And Mary Witteberg from Gibraltar School, where I went to school, she's done a really great job at creating business and entrepreneur classes, and as well as starting a DECA program. And three of the students actually went to the national competition in Atlanta, Georgia this year. So it's happening more and more, bit by bit.
One of the first things you think will get people to live in Door County is to get them to visit Door County. That's step one. What kinds of things are you doing on that front?
Well, we created the ebook DC Bounce, which you can find at dcbounce.com. And it's filled with young business owners and young employees showing that you can be in Door County. You can live, you can work, you can play. That it's not just a destination for your grandparents, which, better or worse, I feel like a lot of people have that idea about it, that there are a lot of great opportunities for young people. So we've sent out that ebook, and we're actually going to be targeting Madison millennials with a strategic targeting to them down here to get them interested and to have it just get in front of their face.
There is that sense, I guess, like you were saying sometimes, that going to these traditional vacation destinations, the North Woods or Door County, is something that someone's grandparents did or that families have done for a long time, that it's not unique. What would you say is unique and worth visiting when someone is considering that versus, you know, something that's more exotic?
Well, a main reason we wanted to target people, Madison millennials specifically, is that we know they're making great salaries, but they don't really have a lot of time off to plan this exotic vacation. So we're not trying to take the space of that. We're trying more to target them. Like, we know you're working really hard. You've only got maybe a day to plan this vacation. Why not come to Door County? It's 3.5 hours away. Enjoy the weekend, and we hope that you come back again.
And what are a few of your favorite things to do? If you wanted to sell someone right now about, you know, taking that first visit to Door County, they're 23 years old. Why should mm-hmm. they go?
Oh, man, there's a lot.
What should they do?
Okay. First off, I would say you have to see a sunset in Ephraim. It's beautiful, picturesque. You have to go to Door County Brewing in Bailey's Harbor. They just opened, and you won't even believe that you're in Door County. It's so awesome. As well as visit Main Street Market for a really great local family-owned grocery store, and Allison Bay Pottery in Allison Bay. They've got demonstrations and just a really cool affordable art. That's another thing we're trying to plug, is that you is the concept of buying art as a millennial. So and kayaking on Cave Point.
Excellent. So a list there, and there's a lot more in your ebook as well. Let's go to our caller here. Diane joins us next in Allison Bay. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What do you think? What do you want to add?
I'd like to ask Caitlin if she would talk about the growing music and art scene. I know she touched on art a little bit, but the music scene in Door County and how it's growing and what direction it's going into.
That's a great question. We have a lot of great folk artists and really active, not only in Door County, but also across the state. A lot of, you could go to a concert, I think a different person every week. They're all out throughout Door County. And the art scene there is really great. It's not just kind of maybe more conservative types of art. It's really like painting, pottery, ceramics, sculpture. There's some great sculpture gardens in Door County. So it's really becoming a lot more interesting, I think.
And you talked earlier about, the whole thrust of this is to get people to visit Door County, millennials hopefully move there. What are you worried about if that doesn't happen?
I am a very positive person, so I'm hoping that I'm not trying to be so negative, but, you know, to be very blunt, in the next 5 to 10 years, if we don't get young people moving and increasing enrollment in our schools, which are dwindling, and our, you know, the class sizes are already really small, there's not going to be people around to fill these service industries, like working at retirement homes, working in the grocery store. I'm really adamant that we need to get people up there and help them fall in love and start a family and really, put down roots in Door County.
We've seen in the last 10, 20 years, you know, the advent and the growth of social media, Facebook, people are more interconnected than they ever were before. Do you think that would make it easier for someone to do what you're talking about, move there, start a family, but still stay connected?
Definitely. And this is going to sound a bit silly, but we've really increased the stability of our internet. So we've got DSL and cable, and we've really made it a lot stronger. Because we are in the middle of nowhere, it was a bit hit or miss. And AT&T is finally, I think someone told me they're going to be in Fish Creek and Ephraim, which again sounds a bit silly, but these are things that people think about. So yeah, it's gotten, you know, you can really be in Door County and be running a business and even connecting internationally and not have to worry about being in an urban environment.
And you can get a pretty great public radio signal in Door County.
Yes, we can.
So that's another plus. Have you seen evidence that, you know, this is working? The millennials are moving to Door County.
I think the millennials we're seeing that are moving to Door County are people that have grown up there and are able to start a business, either like a restaurant or something in hospitality. And that's really great, and we want to keep cultivating that. But I think that we don't have to limit it to just that.
And in terms of what you were talking about, a future where there might not be enough people to fill the service jobs, would that mean that, you know, the Door County, you know, that so many people love to visit is in danger?
I would say yes. In order to really overemphasize the importance of reaching out to millennials, I would say yes. I think that we really need to create better efforts in our community to reach out to young people and in Door County now, as well as in other parts of the state, to really make sure that our economy continues to grow and the population continues to grow.
Is that your one wish for Door County, to see it, you know, thriving and in teeming with people and families?
Definitely. Yes, definitely.
Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking to social media strategist and millennial Caitlin Olson about what it will take to attract younger people to visit and to live in Door County. And Caitlin, once more, the address of your ebook if people want to check it out.
Yes, dcbounce.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today political editor Paul Singer. Today, he's going to share his findings that Congress is expanding its press offices while decreasing legislative staff.
First, the Federal Trade Commission announced yesterday that they're pursuing legal action against cell provider T-Mobile. The FTC claims that the company scammed customers out of hundreds of millions of dollars by adding what they call bogus charges onto customers' bills.
It's a practice evidently known as cramming, which the FTC has been trying to crack down on in recent years. But T-Mobile's CEO is defending the company, saying the charges are unfounded and without merit.
Brendan Sasso joins us now. He's a technology correspondent for National Journal. Brendan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
So it seems like T-Mobile has some mud on its face right now. This is a company that purports to be consumer-friendly, taking on the giants, and yet they've got these allegations about bogus fees going on. What's happening?
Right. It doesn't look great for T-Mobile. They try to advertise themselves as the un-carrier. They're the smallest of the four cell phone carriers. So they try to seem like they're cooler than the evil AT&T and Verizon. But here they're being accused by the government of overbilling customers. And it's not just a few isolated incidents. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And what they say is, you know, that, I mean, and this isn't that, these aren't just charges that T-Mobile is putting on out of the blue. These are third parties that are requesting that T-Mobile add the charges. But T-Mobile got a good cut out of the amount of money of these extra services that people allegedly didn't even want.
So they're getting a kickback from these, but how did it work? How did these charges end up showing up on people's bills in the first place?
Well, I think sometimes people, you click on an ad online and you think you're going to win a prize for a free iPad or something. And, you know, in a lot of cases, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And a lot of these companies get your phone number and then they just add that. They sign you up for some service that you didn't want. And sometimes these companies just go around and buy lists of phone numbers. So even if you're a consumer who did nothing wrong, you end up with fees on your phone bills. And in a lot of cases, people don't even know that they don't notice the bills. They notice the charges on their bills. So there's nothing they can do about it because they don't even know that they're getting charged for it.
Well, so how did they get found out?
So the FTC has been doing an investigation. They brought cases against other companies, usually the third parties that are putting the charges on there. This is their first big case against the actual phone company itself. So the FTC did their investigation. They found a lot of these fees that were buried in people's bills. They, according to the FTC, T-Mobile, even when it should have become aware that a lot of these fees were bogus, didn't really do anything to remove them or refund consumers.
Now, you said the process is called cramming. I'm only familiar with that term as regards to, you know, college. You're studying for a paper or something late. So what exactly is cramming?
That's just the word that they use to describe adding these unwanted charges on phone bills. And it's been a problem for a while on landline bills, but it's becoming more of a problem on mobile phone bills. It's a little more complicated to catch on mobile phones because people sometimes do sign up for extra services for their mobile phone. That might be something that they would want to have added to their phone bill. But in a lot of cases, this one was, you know, horoscope information, flirting tips, celebrity gossip, and things that people didn't actually want. And I'm not even sure in most cases whether they got sort of any service at all. They just got these charges.
So what kind of action is the FTC likely to take against T-Mobile?
So they're going to court. They said they had settlement negotiations but weren't able to reach an agreement with T-Mobile. So they want to get refunds for consumers, and so this would be hundreds of millions of dollars potentially that they could try to get back to people. The FTC doesn't actually have fining authority, so there's no way they can really punish T-Mobile beyond forcing them to refund consumers. But the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has launched its own investigation. And the FCC does have fining authority, so it's possible if the FCC concludes that there were violations here, they could bring their own action where T-Mobile could face further punishment.
T-Mobile has sort of billed itself as this maverick company that's trying to shake things up, take on the giants. How damaging is this going to be for them ultimately with its customers?
I mean, it's hard to say. They're struggling already in the marketplace. You know, their network isn't as good as AT&T and Verizon, and that's something that a lot of people want. But they try to cut costs, and they try to offer people plans that, you know, are more competitive, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not sure, you know, how much publicity this will get. You know, it certainly doesn't look good for them, especially because they have this brand, and it certainly hurts that.
And what does this bigger picture mean for other carriers and I guess the practice of cramming? Do companies have to be more careful now?
Sure. I mean, I think what T-Mobile is saying is, sure, there were probably unauthorized charges on people's bills, but they did what they could to stop it, and it's not really fair for the FTC to be singling them out. And on a press call with reporters, the FTC didn't really answer whether they think other companies are doing this as well. They brought a case against T-Mobile, and they said, you know, they have the evidence for that, but they didn't really say whether other companies are also doing this. So in some ways, at least, it's a warning message to the other companies that they better get in line or they could face similar charges.
As a customer, most of us don't pore over our cell phone bills. Does this mean we need to have a little more buyer beware going on with our cell phone companies and charges?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, in this case, would have been really tough for somebody to find these bills. You know, a lot of times you would look, it was buried under some sort of other category. And when you actually looked at it, it was just a jumble of numbers and letters. But you were supposed to know that was you getting billed for horoscope information. But yeah, I think, you know, if you look at it and all of a sudden you're getting charged an extra $10 a month and you don't know why, it's probably worth trying to figure that out and trying to get the company to cancel it.
So it seems often what happens in cases like this is that the company is kind of contrite, I'm thinking about Target, with their data breach. In this case, T-Mobile doesn't seem to be very contrite. They've sort of said, you know, we are handling this and you're being unfair. Are they taking the right approach?
I mean, that's tough to say. I think that, you know, I'm not necessarily the public relations expert, but I think that, you know, if they're going to go to court and they're going to try to fight it, you know, maybe they don't want to be publicly admitting wrongdoing, and who knows, maybe they'll be able to prove that they weren't responsible for this, or maybe their strategy is to just say the other phone companies do it too and they aren't any worse. The CEO, who's pretty famous for his colorful language and tweets, had some interesting tweets after the charges were filed, sort of saying that this is a conspiracy with the lobbying of big lobbying of the other carriers. And he said, "Hey FTC, did you lose Randall's address?" Referring to Randall Stephenson's, the CEO of AT&T. So I guess they're trying to keep the image that they have as a sort of rebellious upstart, even though they're facing a federal lawsuit.
Interesting. Well, so there's been some talk recently of a merger between T-Mobile and Sprint. What do you think this says about that?
I'm not sure that at the end of the day that it's going to be really critical to that merger. I'm not sure that the antitrust investigation of that would really be informed by, this sort of separate legal issue. But, you know, it certainly doesn't look good for the companies when they're trying to, I think that merger would face a lot of resistance from regulators. And so they don't want to be doing anything that looks bad on any front.
Brendan, do you have any parting advice for T-Mobile customers who might be listening?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, customers of any carrier, like you had said, I think it's important to check your bill and probably don't click on those online ads that tell you you can get a free iPad. Don't
fill in your phone number.
Yeah.
Right. No social security numbers. So keep it clean, Brendan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking to Brendan Sasso, a technology correspondent at National Journal.
During the past 3 years, the U.S. House of Representatives has trimmed its committee staff by about 20%, a money-saving measure led by Speaker John Boehner.
During that same time period, however, the chamber increased its press office staff by nearly 15%. The trend suggests a possible emphasis on political messaging over actual legislation and investigation. Central Times Weekly congressional expert, USA Today politics editor Paul Singer, reported that story today.
Also in congressional news, today is the 50th anniversary of the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act. While lawmakers celebrated that anniversary at the Capitol this morning, it raises the question, could today's Congress actually pass that kind of bipartisan legislation? USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us now and every week at about this time to hold Congress's proverbial feet to the fire. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Rob? Good talk to you.
Yeah, well, the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, a lot of talk today about the significance of that. How does it fit into the significance as far as a part of congressional history?
Well, you know, there are moments in congressional history when Congress sort of, you know, rises up to do fairly dramatic things. And keep in mind, the Civil Rights Act was not a standalone piece of legislation, right? There were several other bills around that same time that were passing through Congress, you know, that really dramatically reshaped America. You know, the Voting Rights Act was part of that as well. And, you know, there's this whole Great Society project that that LBJ was driving. Now, of course, there will be people who will argue now that some of those laws have, the time has come and passed for them and they're no longer relevant, whatever. You can, you know, there's a whole series of political arguments to be made. But I think it is very clear that Congress was sort of reshaping the history of the nation at that period of time, which, of course, they're not doing now with the couple of kind of outstanding exceptions. I mean, I think the Health Care Act is the one, the Affordable Care Act is the only thing close to it that's happened in the past, you know, I don't know, decade or so, where a real sweeping piece of social legislation has passed. And even that was almost completely partisan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Civil Rights Act took a lot of across-the-aisle negotiating and agreement. Is there a chance that something like that could happen in today's partisan Congress?
No. I mean, no. The only thing that can pass in a Congress like this is if we're attacked again by terrorists and another Patriot Act is passed. When there's this moment that everyone decides that being American matters more than being whatever party you're defending. But the way Congress operates, there is increasingly little agreement on almost anything. And every bill is an opportunity to message why your opposition, why your opponent party are bad human beings. It's not an opportunity to make major legislation, to make major policy.
You talk to Congress people, do they look back on something like the Civil Rights Act and think maybe wistfully or something like, hey, why can't we do that? Or is that just ancient history?
Yeah, we have these conversations a lot, actually, with members talking about how, oh, remember when we used to all get together and we'd, you know, go out and have dinners together and we'd have these events and stuff and we'd, you know, get to know each other and then we could cooperate across the aisle. I'm not entirely sure it's true, honestly. I mean, there's a lot of social activity still. Members of Congress play in, you know, the annual softball game and the baseball game and the football game and the soccer game. And, you know, they do actually, you know, hang out and get to know each other. But the fact of the matter is that their votes are cooked into a political system that requires them to be as combative as possible. The nation is not currently willing to see people compromise to achieve big goals. It's just not where we're at as a nation.
Well, let's get into some of how Congress does stuff today. You did a behind-the-scenes article out today looking at maybe a quantifiable trend in Congress of prioritizing political messaging over actual legislating. What did you find?
Well, we started to look at a couple of committees that we thought had, you know, significantly large press operations. And, of course, as we were looking at it, we had to think, well, compared to what? I mean, how big is this press operation? You've got, you know, eight people doing press. Is that a big or a small committee press operation? And so we compared back a few years. What we discovered is that the number of committee staff overall in the House of Representatives has dropped by about 20% since 2010, which is when the Democrats ran the chamber last. There were, at that point, about 1,500 committee staff. Now there's about 1,200 committee staff. But in the same time period, the number of press staff on those committees has risen from about 75 to about 85, and they make up a bigger chunk of the committee's work. We also know that there are other members of staff that talk to the press and do communications as well, and that you can actually count. You can see that Congress is clearly, even as it's trying to save money and cut down on staff and resources, it's clearly emphasizing communications, press, Twitter, Facebook, and sort of just a general talking about itself.
Well, tell us about the people on these committees. Are they neutrals brought in from the outside to do some of the heavy legwork, or are they partisan appointees?
They are all partisan appointees, almost all partisan appointees. There are some exceptions. But you are hired by, usually, you are hired by either the chairman, that is the majority party, or the ranking member of the minority party to serve those members, the Democrats or the Republicans, on that committee. There are a couple of exceptions, and in some cases, they end up hiring, you know, experts in a field, particularly on the defense committees, you'll see this, on the appropriations spending committees, you'll see this. They hire these professional staff members who really are professionals in an area like, you know, I don't know, Mideast peace talks, because you need experts who are able to then tell Congress whether or not they're getting the price they should be getting for buying this particular widget or for, you know, building this weapon system. Some of those folks are nonpartisan, but almost everybody else is a partisan appointee, and the spokespeople, the press people, are entirely partisan.
So you've seen an increasing proportion, even as the overall number is cut, there's more press and communications types in there. You work with these committees as part of your job. You listen to what they say, try to get information from them. Does it feel different? Does it feel less accomplishy, more talky?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things we got to start on this is that some of these committees, you know, I mean, they produce very little legislation. They don't have meaningful hearings to move a topic, to move a subject area. And I went back and I looked at some old hearings on both Republican and Democratic committees, you know, hearings about steroids in baseball, hearings about FDA regulation of drugs, hearings even about, you know, the Medicaid donut hole, whatever it is, you know, things that government should be looking at. Are we spending our money properly and things like that? They just don't do much of that anymore. Now they have hearings that say stuff. If it's a Democratic-run hearing, you'll see a hearing about, you know, why Obamacare is good for America. If it's a Republican-run hearing, you'll see why Obamacare is bad for America. I mean, they really become just messaging opportunities.
And so what do they do with that? I mean, is this do they get it up on C-SPAN and talk about it there or issue lots of press releases?
It's all, I mean, now they have websites that are dedicated to specific investigations. If you go to the Oversight Committee, they have an entire video department that's doing videos, some of which are just no more than two-minute commercials kind of mocking the administration for something or, you know, for a particular policy. They have, you know, Twitter feeds that are designed specifically to address a particular issue. They have Facebook pages and chats and all this stuff. Now, you could argue that all the development of new technology is required these new staff. But there's also an argument that, in fact, the development of new technology requires fewer staff because fewer people can do more with technology. You no longer need to be, you know, typing up a press release and sending it out in the mail. You no longer need to be answering the paper mail. Now, technology allows you to do a lot of this stuff. But yeah, it's a very different, it's a much more proactive kind of thing where these guys are sending press releases, emails, web things, Twitter posts all day long. And almost all of them, Democrats and Republicans, are about why we are good and the other guys are bad.
And all this public relations must be boosting the image of Congress.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's the lowest it's ever been. At the moment, sorry, I'm missing my most recent Gallup poll in front of me, but I know congressional approval ratings amongst the public are, you know, in the low two digits. 10% of people approve of what Congress is doing, you know. And I think part of it is because everybody demonizes everybody else. And so what you hear is not, gosh, I have a disagreement about immigration. Gosh, we need to handle this issue and figure out a way to work it out. It's, gosh, the other guys are trying to destroy America.
Paul, before we let you go, I want to move on briefly. The Mississippi Senate primary done last week. We thought Senator Thad Cochran had won. His challenger isn't quite buying that yet. Just in 40 seconds or so, what's going on there?
Yeah, it's a circus. Chris McDaniel is the Tea Party challenger. They got to a runoff. In the runoff, Thad Cochran managed to win by about 6,000 votes. Part of the way he did that was by reaching out to Democrats, to black voters, to union voters, and asking them to support him in a Republican primary. A bunch of them did. Chris McDaniel is now alleging that a lot of these people voted illegally because they had already voted in a Democratic primary. Just now, as we were on the phone here, there was a Cochrane press conference going on today that said that McDaniel has no proof of that, and if he, you know, had proof, he would show it. That press conference call apparently got cut off because some hecklers joined the call. I mean, it's become just a circus. McDaniel is raising money as if he's going to file suit. We'll see whether he does.
We'll be watching Mississippi, I guess. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, have a great fourth, Rob.
You too. That's USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to give us the latest news from Congress.